Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 30 and we're dealing with the events starting in the first week of January 1943 through to the end of the second week. As we know by now, the 6th Army is surrounded in Stalingrad and faces another major assault planned by the Russians. Before they go ahead, however, Joseph Stalin wants to give the Germans a chance to surrender. There is no escape for the 249,000 men despite their prayers for a miracle, and Stalin and his generals want done with the 6th Army so they can focus on the south, where the German 1st Panzer Army is trying to escape from the Caucasus. West of the Mummy of Kurgan or Hill at Gumrak Airfield, General Paulus was in his HQ when he heard that three Red Army representatives were asking for permission to enter German lines. They had an ultimatum for the 6th Army. While a rendezvous was called for at 10 a.m. Moscow time on January 8th, Paulus refused to attend, but he did send Captain Willich from his HQ. At the appointed hour, three Russian parliamentarians walked under a white flag into German lines and delivered General Rokossovsky's offer to Captain Willich. What was being offered was certainly enticing. Rokossovsky said there would be guarantees of safety to all who ceased to resist, and they would be returned to Germany at the end of the war. The Russians said all personnel could keep their belongings and valuables, but probably the most tempting argument was about food. The Germans were starving to death, and General Rokossovsky said in his personal message that all officers and men who surrender would immediately receive normal rations. Even if that was true, the Russians had no idea about the exact number of Germans in the Kessel. They estimated it was around 86,000, whereas, as we know, it was closer to 250,000. There would not have been enough food available at that very moment to honor the offer of normal rations. The Russians demanded an answer within 24 hours, or the Germans would suffer total destruction, said the emissaries. General Paulus dutifully sent the proposal to Hitler and then asked for what was known as freedom of action. He wanted options, perhaps to surrender, although he didn't say that. Hitler did not like the idea. That evening, 8th of January, Field Marshal Erich von Manstein entertained guests at Novocherkassk, including General Hans Huber. He was known as Der Mensch, the man, and he had just visited Hitler in East Prussia. There was a chance, opined Der Mensch. Huber had heard that the Führer was planning another attempt to extricate the 6th Army using three panzer divisions from France, and they'd be available by mid-February. He was excited, but Manstein shut him down, constantly changing the subject. There was less than 100 tons a day being airlifted into Stalingrad, while there were around 400 wounded being shipped out. Thousands more wounded were lying awaiting their Kazovac flights at Potomac Airfield and Gumrak. Most of these soldiers would never see Germany again, and Manstein was aware of the finality of it all. And now Paulus received Hitler's answer to his request for freedom of action, which in a nutshell was nine. The Führer was now openly insisting that the 6th Army must fight to the death because that would hold the Russians at bay, allowing the 1st Panzer Army in the Caucasus to escape and would help the entire Russian front. Any proposals of negotiations are to be rejected, not to be answered, and parliamentarians are to be repulsed by force of weapons. Hitler was suggesting Paulus summarily execute the Russian emissaries the next time they appeared. First, though, Huber then flew into Potomac Airfield, where Paulus and his chief of staff Schmidt awaited him. Paulus was in a rush and told his visitors it was impossible for the 6th Army to hold on much longer. Huber was still under Hitler's spell and mentioned the panzers being sent from France, but Paulus just shrugged, then seemed to show some interest. It was his only hope, and he was desperate after all. Remember, Paulus was really only a staff officer who had been promoted into position as a safe bet, which is remarkable, as military operational leadership requires daring and initiative. He was a general who preferred tracing maps to racing across the steppe on top of a tank. This had grave implications for his army right now. And across the steppe, things were eerily quiet on the 9th of January as the Russian ultimatum expired. In their trenches, many Germans were aware of the offer, and now they knew they were expendable. The 10th of January dawned. It had been almost 50 days that the German 6th Army had been holed up in the Kessel, surrounded by Russian forces intent on destroying them. The front line had been too quiet for most of the first week of January, and the more experienced on both sides knew that something big was about to happen. At first that morning, everyone heard what was described as the normal melody of the front line. A crack of a sniper's rifle, a thud of a mortar, a few machine gun rounds, a whistle and pop of the signal flares going up. Now and again, a Russian aircraft dropping bombs or propaganda leaflets. The Germans had been watching the Russian forces building up around the western edge of the Kessel with both frustration and foreboding. Frustration because they had very little ammunition, and foreboding because they knew the likely final assault to overcome their positions was imminent. The number of Germans deserting had increased once more as the starving Lanzers decided that enough was enough. The lack of food was one thing, but a lack of ammunition was another. How were they expected to fight? Some artillery units were now down to one round per gun per day. Operation Koltso, or Ring, began that Sunday, 10th of January. Rokossovsky and artillery commander Voronov were both at the headquarters of the 65th Russian Army when the order to fire was given at exactly 5 minutes past 8 Moscow time. Guns roared, bouncing on the chassis from the recoil as 7,000 artillery pieces and Katyusha rockets opened up. Their barrage lasted 55 minutes, stopping precisely at 9 a.m. Voronov described this as an incessant rolling of thunder, which was so intense that one artillery commander by the name of Colonel Ignatov said, "There are only two ways to escape from an onslaught of this character, either death or insanity." The Russians were focusing much of the artillery venom on the southwestern protuberance of the Kessel, the nose of the anteater, so to speak. There, the German 44th, 29th and 3rd Motorized Infantry Divisions had been strengthened at the last moment by part of the 376th Division. But every regiment was under strength, as we've heard. The 44th had been reinforced with artillerymen and some construction battalions. Several tanks and heavy artillery were allotted to that sector. Just behind them, the Pioneer Battalion's position were two self-propelled assault guns and an 88mm anti-aircraft gun. The Russians were particularly interested in the Pioneer Battalions, and during the bombardment, the Germans watched as their own headquarters were blown to bits. "Nobody came out," one said later. For an hour, 100 guns of various calibers and Stalin organs fired away. Bunkers were heaving and swaying. Then the Red Army launched its attack in terrifying masses of men and women, rolling forward, never flinching. Some carried red banners, and every 50 yards a tank could be seen dotted about. Radio reports began coming in of entire German units wiped out. Others were reeling back from the shattered front. Mobs of frenzied soldiers were already streaming towards the rear, shell-shocked and hysterical, many with blood trickling from their mouths, noses and ears. The force of the bombardment was beyond comprehension. They were the survivors, for now, of Voronov's god of war, as he put it, the heavy artillery. The Lanzers were waiting for the Russians, with fingers swollen from frostbite and lying in their shallow foxholes. They could see the long spiked bayonets and the T-34s carrying infantry. In places, high winds had blasted away the snow, and the steppe was virtually colourless, or a combination of black and yellow. Mortars were bouncing off the frozen surface and exploding as air bursts, which increased casualties. The defences of the 44th were soon smashed, and the men lying in wait were now at the mercy of the Russians and the elements. By the afternoon, the 29th and 3rd Motorized Infantry Divisions and the main nose of the Kessel realised they were being outflanked. Part of the 3rd Division was made up of replacement soldiers who'd just been trained, the cooks, the clerks, who were unable to continue fighting. They were exhausted. Their lack of food meant some were trying to desert their posts. Only the use of a pistol by their commander convinced them to remain in the dismal foxholes. Summary executions were taking place. Survivors later said they had no idea how many. Other units fared better. Amazingly, the scratch company of Panzer Grenadiers I mentioned last episode and led by Sergeant Major Walwe managed to hold out until 10 that night. They were a motley lot, yet fought until they received the order to pull back and just made it to Karpovka station. And yet, they had no rest. The Russians were there first and pushed them further back into the steppe. A little earlier, Pioneer Commander Colonel Herbert Seller had been driving towards the nose of the pocket where his men waited when the massive bombardment began and he realized the forces there were doomed. So he turned towards the headquarters of the 76th Division holding a precarious position at the western side of the perimeter. Later, Seller saw something that saddened him greatly. His car passed a group of wounded men pleading with him to help. He picked up a dozen of these who draped themselves over the hood of his car or stood on the running boards. Seller's odd ambulance then headed to Gumrak Hospital. As he watched the grisly sight of these bloodied troops helping each other into the tents, he wondered what the effect this would have had on General Kurt Zeitzler back in East Prussia. If he could see these wretches inside the Kessel, would Zeitzler continue to merely repeat Hitler's cruel order to fight to the last bullet? Meanwhile, the weakened divisions facing mass attacks of the Russian 21st and 65th Armies, backed by the ground attack aircraft of the 16th Air Army, had no chance. This was Blitzkrieg visited upon the Germans once more, and they were trying to secure both Marinovka and Karpovka. There, the defences had been set up on the south side, but that was virtually useless. The Russians began their attack on both positions from the northwest. Some German units tried counterattacking, but it was suicidal. The Russians used heavy mortars to separate the infantry from the panzers, then obliterated the survivors in the open. Before Operation Koltzow began, Russian troops had learnt the slogan hammered home by the Don Front political department: "If the enemy does not surrender, he must be destroyed." Russian officers were grimly determined to ensure the latter. The 65th and 21st Soviet armies had attacked the Karpovka nose and eventually driven through the defenders, while the 66th Army attacked the 16th Panzer and 60th Motorized Infantry Division at their northernmost point. This is where the undulating hills had been stained a blackish yellow from the Soviet trench mortars and were blasted by the icy dry wind which had blown the snow away. But here, the remaining tanks of the 16th Panzer scored hit after hit on the waves of T-34s charging across the rolling hillocks. In the southern sector of the Kessel, the Russian 64th Army began to bombard the 297th Infantry Division as well as the 82nd Romanian Regiment stationed nearby. The Romanians could not stand the pressure and broke, leaving the Russians a large gap into which they sent their tanks. The German Pioneer Battalion then, led by the semi-suicidal Major Gotzelmann, managed to seal the gap. This part Austrian division had been withdrawn from the Don River area as the Russians launched Operation Luminous, but had not suffered as much as the others. Led by the fanatical Major Gotzelmann, had managed to fight back the 36th Guards and the 422nd Rifle Divisions, along with two more brigades of Marine Infantry and then part of the 13th Russian Tank Corps. 2 days of intense battles, and still the Russians could not overcome this single division. But the Germans and the Austrians seemed to realize that giving up their own lives at this point was futile. Eventually, more than 40 men from the pioneers deserted. As with most special units in most proper armies, they will fight to live rather than fight to die. While the initial heroics held up the Red Army assault, the main Soviet effort in the west had captured Marinovka and Karpovka by the morning of the 11th of January. There were 1,600 German corpses lying around these two towns. Local peasant women then appeared as if from nowhere and began plundering the blankets lying about the dead. "Karpovka looks like a massive jumble sale," said one Russian soldier quoted by historian Anthony Bieber. The intense bombardment had shattered men and machines with bits of everything scattered across the frozen landscape. It was a picture of horror, a real Goya nightmare. Back in Moscow, Stalin was still unhappy. The 6th Army resistance was now verging on superhuman. It was astonishing, even to the average Russian soldier, who was aware by now that the Germans had no food or ammunition. How could they keep fighting? Remember how the Russians fought against overwhelming odds at the beginning of the Battle of Stalingrad. The roles had reversed. The intensity had shifted. The most telling measure were the casualties this weakened German force inflicted on the Soviets as well. In the first 3 days of Operation Koltzow, the Red Army lost 26,000 men and half its tank force. Worse, Soviet commanders had appeared to revert to the policy of making their men charge across open ground in some kind of First World War Tsarist madness. Clumps of men and some women dressed in the Russian brown uniform lay across the steppe as the white camouflage suits were now in short supply once more and reserved for scouts and snipers. It was also now that the Germans were subjected to even more harsh treatment for their refusal to go quietly. The Russians had seen their comrades gunned down in this operation, and many Lanzers who surrendered never made it a step further. Some soldiers and officers of the Red Army vented their anger and shot down the lice and frostbite-infected Germans immediately they held up their hands. Others waited until the Wehrmacht prisoners were on the march, then opened fire with their heavy machine guns, shooting the men down like scythes slicing wheat. In one case, a wounded Russian commander ordered a captured German officer to kneel down, then cried out the reasons why he sought revenge, and then shot him in the head. By the early hours of the 12th of January, the Soviet 65th and 21st Armies had reached the west bank of the frozen Rososhka River, eliminating the Karpovka nose of the Kessel. It was Hermann Göring's 50th birthday on the 12th, but few Lanzers celebrated. Back at Rasenberg Wolf's lair, a message was received, and it wasn't happy birthday, Hermann. Munitions coming to an end, Zeitzler read Paulus's update. His men could only open fire at the closest range because of the lack of ammunition. It was the German wounded who now suffered the most. They had been piled on trucks which promptly ran out of fuel. Most froze to death shortly afterwards. Others, who managed to stagger into Potomac airfield for evacuation, found chaos. Heaps of corpses dumped carelessly about, Russian bombardments pounding the planes and the tents, Junker transport planes crash-landing or being shot down, some overloaded planes stalling on takeoff and nosing over to explode on impact. Walking wounded were rushing their aircraft, ransacking the cargo for food, and then were shot down in droves by the fell gendarmerie. The weakest were being trampled and died. Sergeant Major Walware, who we met earlier as he led the scratch unit of Panzer Grenadiers, ended up as one of the wounded. This is why we know his story. He'd been shot in the stomach, which is usually a death sentence, but somehow the tough Sergeant Major managed to crawl out of one of these fuel-starved trucks and then all the way to the airfield. It took him almost 2 days, but by pure dint of mental power, he made it to the hellhole. As he was being treated, a Russian air raid destroyed most of the medical tents around him. At 3 a.m, this barely living NCO fought his way onto a Junkers and somehow made it out of the nightmare to tell this tale. A gunner with the 44th Infantry Division named Alois Dorner, who was also amongst the injured at Potomac, summed up the situation. "Here was the greatest misery that I have seen in my whole life. An endless wailing of wounded and dying men. Most of them had received nothing to eat for days. No more food was given out to the wounded," Dorner wrote later. He'd been wounded in the left hand and thigh by shell splinters. He was waiting to die. But, like some at that airfield at that time, luck saved him. On the night of the 13th of January, an Austrian pilot of a Heinkel bomber passed by and asked him where he came from. "I am from near Amstetten," Dorner muttered. The pilot called a second man and they carried him to their plane. He was flown out of Hades, Austrian helping Austrian. Across the south, north, and western extremes of the Kessel, Germans were beginning to run. They had condemned the Romanians for the same. Now they were deserting their posts in droves. The boundaries of the Kessel were compressing like a deflating balloon, and soon the Russians would cut off the German airfield at Potomac. Back in East Prussia, however, Adolf Hitler had received an intelligence report update from the field, so to speak. As we'll hear next episode, Hitler received Captain Winrich Boer, who had been dispatched by Field Marshal Manstein on the 13th of January. Boer walked into the Volkskanzler HQ in the early evening and into the same room where 18 months later, Stauffenberg would leave his briefcase filled with explosives. Hitler knew Boer had brought bad news. We'll hear about that next episode. So now we halt. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you have the time or inclination. If you have any comments, please feel free to direct message me on Twitter @DesLatham, or you can email me using the contact form on the website that can be found on the homepage of abwarpodcast.com. Until we meet, goodbye.